Welcome to another episode of the Christian Combatives Podcast. I'm your host and servant in Jesus Christ, Paladin Actual. We have another Scatterbrain Bible study for you guys today. In this Bible study in particular, we talk about some different communion practices. We talk a lot about high church versus low church, what is considered high church, what is considered low church. We ask questions like, is it a waste of money or pretentious to spend a lot of money on making a church fancy? We ask questions like, what are some of the benefits of the tradition of worship or developing traditions of worship? Why do some churches use incense and thuribles? And is there a danger to introducing traditions into the church without teaching? I hope you enjoy. God bless. Take care.
It wasn't an argument. I didn't get into an argument this week. Well, I did, but the argument that I got into this week had to do with Jesus Jewish or Christian, which we already dealt with last week. But now the rest of the internet is fighting over, which has nothing to do with me. I just may have started it. But I was talking with somebody about different communion altar guild, sacristan practices. And apparently, traditionally, the altar guild was male. It was exclusively male. And sometimes it was just the elders. And you'd kind of do a dual task. And what we do here we do the Lord's Supper, and then we finish the service, and then after the service, it's taken down. That's pretty common. But apparently, there's also some traditions where immediately following the Lord's Supper, the elders or the sacristans or whoever's designated comes up and they strip the altar like we do on Maundy Thursday. Well, they basically strip the altar of the communion work, so it's all taken and put away as part of the service. I think I would probably add at least a couple of minutes. I don't know, it could be done, but it would add a couple of minutes. But if you want to get another step fancier than that, there's a, what's it called? Well, the Spanish word is piscina, which is sink. And that's also the Latin word, something like that. There are some places that have a designated, well, we've got one back there. It's where the water doesn't pour into the drain, so we're not dumping the blood of Christ into the sewer. So we pour it in the sink, and then it drains into a bowl or something like that. Well, they have, some places have a designated washing sink. That's what piscina means. And so they would actually wash the communion ware as part of the service, as like putting things away as you're going through them. So there's these different, I don't know if they're different levels of fanciness that you can go through with communion, but it's interesting that I've talked with some people before and they say, well, Mount Olive is a high church setting. Like, well, I mean, maybe relatively speaking, but in sense of how high can we get, we're on like rung two of the ladder that goes 100 up. There's all kinds of, we can keep getting fancier and fancier. Well, that's the problem, is what is considered high church? For some people, high church just means that they don't have a rock and roll band, that it's high church if you use an organ. The fact that we don't have flags, the fact that we don't have an American flag by the altar is considered very high church. That's very rare. If you go to even a lot of churches that have all the stained glass and the organs and all these beautiful things, well, that's the problem, is it can be used as a derogatory term sometimes. It can be, well, your church is high church, our church is normal church. You guys are just putting on airs. Or it can be, well, you're striving for something more traditional, more reverent, more divine, yeah. It's just a term. Yeah, there's not an actual like check mark where we can get a score from 1 to 100, although there are groups and organizations and websites and stuff like that that do try to categorize churches. They say, well, if you're in the area and you want to go to a church that uses divine service set, I'll give you some of the things that make us high church in the eyes of many people. One, we use divine service setting 3 and 2. Both of those are considered high church. Some churches instead use more creative worship. They just kind of, I don't want to say they make things up as they go, but they intentionally don't have structure because structure is too Catholic. That's the argument. That's not true. Structure is Christian. In 1 Corinthians chapter 14, it says that God is a God of order. So we want to have ordered worship. But one of the big check marks is we have divine service setting 3 rather than a kind of contemporary creative worship. Another check mark that we have, obviously, is the flags. Another check mark that we have, this is a big one, is the vestment. So you see, I'll wear an alb, or I'll wear, it escapes me, the black one. You guys got me one for a gift. They called it, the website called it a black alb, which is, alb is short for albino, so it's a black white, but it's a black robe. It's a, oh boy, cassock. There we go. So it's, there we go, yeah. And the particular style that I have is more of the Eastern style cassock, but basically it's the same thing. It's a black robe. So a cassock, an alb, even a clerical collar for some people. This is high church. Why doesn't pastor come out in skinny jeans and a polo? And I need to have more tattoos if I'm going to be, you know, relevant. But
that's a whole other right?
Yeah, and there's, so the question is are there kind of two different lanes there between like contemporary worship and then normal worship, or is it all a spectrum? And again, because high church versus low church is kind of a subjective measurement, it's usually used as an insult. Whichever one that other church is, it's an insult. It's that church is a low church because their pastor plays guitar instead of using an organ. Now the reality is that the organ hasn't always existed. And there, for example, my father was a pastor in Panama. They didn't have stained glass. They had four sticks and they had a thatched roof. And he played guitar. And the altar was a wooden bench. Would that be considered high church? They had an altar, yeah.
There's a lot of churches that don't have altars.
Well, I suppose that's another thing. And some of that has to do with the theology of the church. So if you go into a Lutheran church, more often than not, you're going to have an altar or a table. You can call it either one. It's really both, because it's a table you eat at, and it's the altar that the sacrifice is given to you from. We're not re-sacrificing Christ. Don't take that away. But sometimes it's freestanding, which means you can walk around it. Sometimes it's against the wall. There's reasons for the different ones.
Sometimes
there isn't one. In a Lutheran church, most of the time there will be. Well, yes. There's a stage, but I still would say in Lutheran churches, you're probably going to have a stage, but you're going to have at least a table somewhere in the center. If you go to Pantano, and I know because I went a couple weeks ago, I just wanted to check it out, they do not have an altar. They do not have a freestanding altar. They do not have a communion table. You pick up your Lunchables packet of grape juice and cracker, and you sit down and you consecrate it yourself and you eat it yourself because it doesn't mean anything anyway. I went there, so this is my experience. But this is because as Lutherans, we say that there's two parts of the divine service. There's two major reasons, two major things that we're doing here. Yes, fellowship is good. Yes, this is part of the reason we're here, fellowship. But the two big things here are right there and right here. So most Lutheran churches will have a pulpit or a pulpit and a lectern. Lectern is usually where you read from. Pulpit is where you preach from. The preaching of the word, the service of the word, and if you look in your, I think it says in your bulletins, it'll say the service of the word at the beginning, and then later it'll say the service of the sacrament. The service of the word is the preaching, and the service of the sacrament is the center. This is the Lord's Supper. So it is so important. This is why we have it every Sunday. It is so important that this is why we are meeting together and we are breaking bread together every single Sunday, that we stick it right in the middle of the church. If, on the other hand, you are part of a denomination that does not believe that this is the body and blood of Christ, that this is just a symbol, that this is, it doesn't actually do anything, well, if it doesn't do anything, why would we put it in the middle? Let's put it off to the side. We don't need a designated space for remembering Jesus. After all, he says, do this in remembrance of me, so it must not be his real body and blood, they say. They won't have a pulpit, but they might have, so you'll see a lot of times in these stages, they'll sometimes, and this is another thing, you can often tell the theology of a church by its structure. So we've got this pulpit. It's pretty fancy. You don't see these things usually everywhere. It's different from a podium. It's different from a music stand, that sort of thing. If you go to some of these churches, if you go to a Presbyterian church, I guarantee you they'll have a pulpit there. Preaching is so big. A Calvinist church, preaching is so big, they'll have a designated place for the pastor to preach from. If you go to a church that's more like that church, you'll probably have the pastor. He'll have a microphone in his ear. He'll be walking around the stage. There won't be a designating preaching position, and that's because they don't have They don't have this belief that there is a role of the pastor. The role of the pastor is to specifically preach and teach. It's just somebody is sharing their testimony for the day. They don't have a designated, this is the person's job to preach and teach. If I have a job, I have a uniform, and I have a place where I have to work from. This is my desk. This is the place from which I do my job. This is the place from which I do my job. If everybody is equally a preacher, then there's no reason to have a pulpit. You just pop in a microphone, you stand in front of the praise band, and you give your testimony. So that's why different kind of, even the structures confess different theologies in different churches. But this is why in Lutheran churches, and now there could be examples of Lutheran churches where they don't have an altar, and maybe there's a reason for that, and maybe there's not a good reason for that. But more often than not, in Lutheran churches, even if they have a stage, up in the middle, they're going to have an altar. And it won't, I've never seen an altar off to the side. Either you have it or you don't. I've never seen it to the side.
In California,
though, it was an altar. Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, that says something. That says something when you're like, you know what? Let's move that to the side. We need a place for our flag waivers or whatever. But, yeah. It's okay. I went to an Elka church in, it was actually up by Mountain View. It's where Google headquarters is. My grandmother had died, and I went to that church for her funeral, and I was actually having a really great conversation with the pastor, and he was, he seemed like he was sincere and trying. I always feel bad when there's somebody older than me, especially a pastor who's older than me, and I correct his theology. Because I was like, who am I? But he said something, and I said, oh, that's interesting. What do you make of this Bible verse that says the exact opposite? And I was doing it as politely as I could and everything. It was really great. I actually liked the guy, and I wish we could have talked more. But yeah, I'm not a member of his congregation. as far as Elka churches go, there is a spectrum of how bad they can get. And unfortunately, the good end of the spectrum is very quickly going away. But we're struggling with that in the LCMS as well. So anyways, so the different, what was I getting on about this for? Yeah, so the different kind of structures, the different, oh, high church, low church, that kind of thing. So really it's kind of a subjective term, high church and low church. There are a lot of things that people will say, well, there are a couple of high churches in Tucson. We're one of them. Catalina is one of them. Maybe Peace in the Valley would be, but they've got flags, and we have our flags out where they should be. but they have a beautiful pipe organ. They've got like bells and chimes and stuff. There's marble. Sometimes the definition of high church comes with a price tag. If you've got all kinds of golden and platinum communion ware, and everything is marble, and you've got stained glass and the most beautiful pipe organ, and people walk in, they say, this is a high church place. I'm like, well, they have a lot to work with financially. So the question of high church can often be subjective. Is it high church if you've only got, I'll give you another example. When I am preaching, or when I was preaching, when I was doing chaplain work, we didn't have a designated chapel. Sometimes I would stack up MRE boxes, or it'd be the front of a Humvee. Now, if I've got the front of a Humvee, and I bring some pyramids, because of course I do, and I throw some green on the front of the Humvee, and I've got a stole, but other than that, I'm wearing my, she's helping out. Other than that, I'm wearing my camouflage utilities. Is that high church? We don't have stained glass or organ. Hi. Oh, dear. You want a high five?
Yeah.
That's fine. That's fine. She's not causing trouble. So sometimes the structure, sometimes the stuff you can buy gives you an indication of how sacred of a space, or how seriously they take the sacred space. Sometimes it's just a budget issue. We just don't have it in the budget to have a massive pipe organ and a huge, just like all the bells and whistles. It's just not in the budget. Sometimes it's not feasible. When I'm traveling in the military, we've got boxes of MREs, and we've got a Humvee cover, or the front of the Humvee. That's what you got to work with. So really, high church, you can notice it. It can be indicated by how you have the church organized, but it really comes down to what is being taught and how it's being taught. Yes, sir.
Don't I was
you're talking about you can do what you have back in the Bible, something important, the pillar, the stairway up and down.
Oh, Jacob? Or no? Jacob's ladder? Oh, yeah. Yeah, he uprights a stone. Yeah. So Jacob turns upright a stone and it turns into an altar. It is a holy place. Moses goes to the burning bush, and the only thing different there is that the bush is on fire, but it's holy ground, so he takes off his sandals. So there are some places, sometimes in the Bible, where you have a holy place that's not necessarily indicated by all the trappings that we have here. On the other hand, think about the tabernacle and how many specific commands from God were. I mean, there's chapters of, and use this kind of fabric and use this kind of gold and build these bowls and how many, you know, candles and all these other things and this seat and this is how you shall design it. This many cubits by this many spans by this many whatever. And God does put a lot of effort into building a very nice church, even though it's a tent. The tabernacle is a tent. The word tabernacle actually means dwell. So when God dwells among us, the word is God tabernacles among us. It's a movable location, which is a foreshadow of Christ being the true temple, and he moves with us. So that's what that's about. But it's fancy. The Jacob's stone altar, not terribly fancy. Moses is taking off his sandals before a burning bush. Not terribly fancy. Sometimes you work with what you've got. But when God blesses people, it's not a sin to make an extravagant worship space. And this is an accusation sometimes. Jesus, that perfume that this woman poured on you could have been sold and given to the poor. Yes, it could. But there's something to be said for investing in worship. One of the accusations against the Roman Catholic Church and also the Eastern Orthodox Church is that they build these huge grand cathedrals. And couldn't you have used that money for the poor instead? Like, yeah, you could have. You could have used all of the gold from the tabernacle for something else as well. But there are examples in Scripture where God commands not just the tabernacle, but the temple is extravagant. It is unbelievable. I mean, obviously the temple's been torn down and all the gold has been removed from it. But man, can you imagine the Temple of Solomon in its heyday? It would have been just unimaginably glorious. And so there is a degree in which people say, well, Pastor, when you put on the stole, when you put on the altar, when you have these fancy communion, you're putting on airs, you're being snobby, you're being obnoxious, you're showing off, things like that. And it's no, we're glorifying God in as best as we can. And if you're a widow and you've got two mites, that glorifies God. And if you're Lydia, the purple dye maker, and you've got a lot of money, and you could glorify God with a lot of money, then that's good too. You work with what you have, and you glorify God in as best as you can with what you have. So if you've only got four sticks in the ground and a thatched roof hut, at least sweep. At least, you know, try to clean the area, tidy it up a little bit, tidy up your... If you're a POW in a dirty camp, try to clean the area where you're going to meet and worship together. Do what you can with what you have. Yes, ma'am. Oh, boy. Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is that all that we have comes from God in the first place. Now, 10% isn't that much if you've got a dollar, but 10% is a lot if you've got $1 billion, right? Yeah, we have to be careful with the money. We have to spend our money appropriately. At the same time, it's not a waste to have nice pyramids. It's not a waste to have a clean area to worship. It's not a waste. You know, we could just sell this building. I'm sure Pantano will pay us $30,000 for the building at least. It's worth more. We could sell this building and we could all just meet up at Red Roof Inn or, you know, whatever. We could meet up at Denny's every Sunday. Yeah, we could meet up outside. We could find somebody who's got an empty lot. And we could meet up outside and we could give away all of our money to the poor and we could have no money at all spent on the worship setting. But the reality is, again, this is not what God has called us to do. Yes, sir. Yeah, it can be. I mean, we can have an idol out of looking high church, looking fancy. We can say, well, this other church over here, everybody respects them because they're, you know, they're we want to look like that church. And I, as much as I rail against the argument that that's too Catholic argument, there are some cases where that actually applies, where people say, you know what, Pastor, you should be wearing the Cappella Romano. You should be wearing that hat. You should be, you know, you should dress like this. Why? Well, because that's what the Catholics do. If that's the approach, well, that's what the high churches do. You should do this to look like these other people. I don't think that that's a good argument. And I think you can easily make an idol out of saying, well, we need to have a bigger church in order to worship. We need to have a fancier church in order to compete. We need to have a projection screen to compete with Benteno. They got 3 projection screens. We need to have all of these things, and we can make an idol out of the stuff. But it comes down to what the reason why. It's an issue of the heart. Why? Are we trying to make a worship space that more glorifies God, that is better suited to give you God's good gifts as best as possible, to be comfortable, to have air conditioning, all these other things? Or are we trying to be fancy for the sake of being fancy and being recognized by others? Yes, sir, you had something? Yeah, is it in service to the service? Is it in service to the mission of the church, or is it spectacle? And this can be with other things as well. So, for example, we collect food for the food bank in service to the community. We could easily make a charitable program for the church for the sake of being recognized by the community. We could make it more of a spectacle.
We could easily have a half hour of announcements.
We could have a half hour of announcements, yes. But we print it all in the bulletin, so it doesn't need to be there. But no. And this is a big question about, and this is a constant, I don't want to say it's constantly evolving, but it's constant. We're constantly rechecking the service. We're trying to say, look, for example, we had announcements at the beginning for a while, and we had announcements at the end. We wanted to try that out for a while because we worried people would forget the announcements on the way out the door, but that got in the way of the music. It interrupted the flow of the service. I've seen another place where people have the announcements right in the middle of the service, which the argument for that is it divides the service of the word and the service of the sacrament. So you know that you're getting 2 things on the Sunday. But then again, that gets in the way. Then like the flow, like, so there's problems with everything that we do. Yes. Yeah. And so what you mentioned got me thinking of traditionally, how did the earliest Christian church do worship service? They probably had announcements. They probably, you know, Paul sent us another letter. Church of Corinth. This is the 4th one this week. My understanding of the structure would be that, first of all, the services would be multiple hours long because you could get away with that back then. But people would meet together, and they would have the procession of the cross and everything like that. But what would happen is the people would meet together. They wouldn't necessarily have an organ, but they would be singing psalms together, or they would be chanting psalms together. And they'd go through a long number of psalms. They'd just be kind of singing together. There weren't pews. Everybody was standing up in this building. They would all be singing together. And then when the procession came in, that was when, I mean, the service really began when the people showed up. As soon as you show up to church, you start praying, you start singing psalms. That's kind of building towards it. But then you would see, everybody would see the cross moving forward, and they know, okay, now it's time to kind of stop with the psalms, and we're going to get into the divine service. And then you would go forward from there. And depending on how early the Christian, I mean, I don't think they had the procession of the crucifix probably in the first, I'm trying to think, you know, a couple of years after Jesus died, they've already got a crucifix. Probably not, I'm guessing. I mean, maybe they had a crucifix that early, but I was just thinking they would have a time when Paul wrote us a letter. So they would read, if they're a church in Corinth, well, let's say they're not the church in Corinth, they're another church. Paul wrote this letter to the church in Corinth, and we're going to read it cover to cover, all in one sitting, all in one standing. And that would be a part of the divine service as well. You had something, yes. There's something to be said for that tradition. And for some people, they say it's old-fashioned, and yeah, it is. And the reason that is because this is like the church I went to when I was a kid. This is like the church you went to when you were a kid. And yes, it's old. So, people come into the church and they're not familiar with the tradition. Oh, it's different. Yes, it is different from what you're used to, but it's not different from what generations of Christians are used to. So when you join up with a church that has these ancient traditions, even if they're new to you, you're being grafted into this ancient practice. And you can say, you know, this person's mother, this person's great grandmother worshiped in the church, and she sang the church is one foundation and you know, mighty fortress and all these other things. So the tradition actually connects us with our ancestors, with our ancestors in the Christian church. It also helps me a lot if I ever have to visit somebody in the hospital, and let's say they're an older generation, and this happened when I was on field work. So I wasn't familiar with the congregation really. I visited them in the hospital. They were 95 or something like that. Lifelong Lutheran. I didn't know anything about them. But when I started singing hymns that I knew, they were able to kind of mouth along with, they weren't able to sing at that point. They were able to mouth along with the hymns. They were able to kind of sway a little bit with the hymns. They were able to pray the Lord's Prayer and say the Apostles or the Nicene Creed. I had this tradition that I could say, I don't know anything about. For example, if I met your mother, I don't know anything about your mother, but if I started saying the Lord's Prayer, she could say it along with me. We're connected through that tradition. In German, oh, well, yeah, I don't know it. Let's say I don't quite know it in German. But yes, right. But here's the thing is, I think this is one of the things that you notice it when it's missing. You notice it more when it's missing. So we don't pay attention so much to the air conditioning until it stops working. Then it's a big deal. Maybe we don't pay attention that much to the organ and the organist until we don't have one. Then, oh boy, what do we do? Well, we've got some CDs, we've got an iPad, but it's not quite the same. It doesn't work as well. I suppose something could be similarly said about the pastor. If you just had somebody come in and read pre-written sermons, you'd notice, you could tell. But there's a lot of work that goes into the music, a lot of work that goes into the church behind the scenes. Maybe it doesn't get as much appreciation as it did, but if the person stopped doing it, you know. Anyways, oh yeah, one last one.
One more. I noticed we don't have a lectern. Is there a reason?
Yeah, space. That's the only reason we don't have a lectern is space. So, and then there's a fight over which side it goes on to. I've seen it on both sides. So the difference between the lectern and the lectern is read from, the pulpit is preached from. Churches, when they just physically don't have enough space, we combine the two and we have the lectern, we have the pulpit. But a lot of what you would see in a lot of churches is, hypothetically, if you had a lectern, it would be here. Well, okay, where do we stick the choir? I guess we could have a lectern on wheels. We shove it out of the way if we, you know, but it's invading the poor organist's space or the piano player's space. So hypothetically, we could have a lectern. And that's where it would go, yeah. I've never seen a lectern right next to a pulpit before. I've never seen that. I always see the left and the right side, and they're supposed to represent the different horns of the altar, and I'd have to get into the Old Testament, like the different horns of the altar represented different things or something. I don't remember exactly. But yeah, so the reason we don't have a lectern is we just, maybe we could fit it in the space, we just, it would be kind of crowded. If you want to donate a lectern, I'll use it. We just have to hook up the sound. Now, if you go to a German church or a European church before they had sound systems, a lot of times you would have the pulpit wouldn't be at the front. The pulpit would be in the middle. There'd be kind of a spiral staircase. There'd be a pillar in the middle, and the pastor would be preaching from right about there. So everybody would have to, you know, turn in their pews or whatever. And there's a kind of spiral staircase, and the pastor would be up there preaching. I'm not sure if that's where the readings were done from as well. It might be. But the pulpit was done in the middle. And again, just for acoustic purposes, we got a microphone system now, so nobody has to turn in their pews. But yeah, it's a logistical. It's really just a logistical. When we have a cathedral, the Mount Olive Cathedral. Is there a biblical precedent for having a lectern? Yes. Not in the sense of something like this, in the sense of, and you can read this when Jesus is handed the scroll from Isaiah. You remember, he's handed the scroll and he unrolls it. He reads from it and he says, today this prophecy is fulfilled in your presence. Well, it says that when he's handed the scroll, he sits down. Now in the ancient, well, I would say the ancient church, in the synagogues, the position of teaching was the teacher would sit and everybody else would stand. We kind of think about it the other way around now. But the teacher would sit, and there would be a designated seat to sit down and to teach from. In that sense, you could say there was a lectern. It had a scroll instead of a book, and you know, so different things would be different. But there was a designated teaching and preaching kind of location. So he sat down, he unrolled the scroll, he read from it, he rolled it back up, and then he preached sitting down while everybody else stood. Now everybody is sitting, and I'm teaching standing up. But,
He
was in the same place, yeah. So he sat down, it was a designated chair, and he would sit down, he would read, and he would teach from there, yeah.
But that was the lectern and?
That was the lectern and the pulpit. Okay, I see what you're saying there, yeah. So, again, yeah, there are traditions that develop that separate the lectern from the pulpit, and then they would read the gospel from the middle, and there's all kinds of fancy we could do. We're working up to it. The next step is incense. Everybody's going to be coughing. It's going to be smoke. It's going to be like Isaiah 6. You're going to walk in and you're going to see the Lord in all his glory, and the incense fills the heavens and the earth. His train fills. Yeah. So that's the next step. When you come in and there's smoke pouring out, like, oh, the church is on fire. It's like, no, pastor just won the lottery. He got a thurible the size of a basketball. He's swinging it around. There's smoke going everywhere. Yeah, well, so there is, yeah. So if you're curious, the brass thing that you swing around is called a thurible. I actually looked this up recently because there's different traditions. The Catholics, the Anglicans, the Eastern Orthodox, and the Lutherans are the only ones who really do it anymore. I've never seen a Presbyterian swing a thurible before. I would love to see it in like a bow tie and everything. But they're doing it for different reasons. So for the Roman Catholics, for the Eastern Orthodox, it's more kind of like a good luck charm, like a ceremony you go through to magic some good onto some different areas. The Lutherans do it to kind of indicate you swing it three times. There's a whole presentation I could show you if you really want to. The short version of the presentation is you don't have to do it. It doesn't actually do anything. It's not a sacrament. God doesn't command you to put incense in the church, but incense was traditionally, going as far back as the Old Testament, incense was always a part of the church. So it's as traditional as candles themselves. How you do it, we don't have to follow the Old Testament temple procedures for incense. So if we use incense, we use incense with the teaching that we are free in Christ to use incense or to not use incense, and based on the situation, if it makes sense. At this point, I haven't taught enough about incense, and I haven't had enough people saying, hey, we want incense, to introduce incense. So if I just came in one day and I was swinging incense around, that wouldn't benefit anybody. It would just, a bunch of people would just start coughing. And I, you know, it's like, why is pastor doing this? Because he's weird. Like, yeah. So hypothetically, in some scenario, so if you're a Redeemer Fort Wayne Lutheran Church, and they do everything you can think of, they have all the traditions. For them to use incense, fine. They've got 5 pastors and 12 Bible studies. They can teach about incense all day, and then they can have incense. We're not there, and I don't know that we're going to get there. It's just that tradition for that church is different than ours. Yes?
Form reflects doctrine. Doctrine reflects the form.
Yes. But with everything in the form that you do, you have to teach. What doctrine, too, you have to teach? You have to teach. So you can't just say, well, let's say hypothetically this church was used to pastor showing up in a suit and tie every single Sunday preaching with a suit and tie. And then I showed up one day in a clerical, I showed up in full regalia. I had stole, I had all that other stuff. There is a good chance that everybody would be scandalized. They would say, what is going on here? I'm so distracted by what he's wearing. I just can't focus. I would be getting in the way of the teaching because I would have made such a radical change so quickly. I think it's good to wear a clerical collar. I think it's beneficial for the reasons I've explained before, like it's a uniform. It indicates what I'm doing. It says that I'm a sinner, but what I'm preaching is the pure word of God. I think it's good, the things that I'm wearing, but if it's not accompanied with teaching, it's a clanging cymbal. It's a noise. It's a thing that's going on, and nobody knows why. And maybe you drown out that noise. That's going to be in the sermon, drowning out a noise. Maybe you drown out that noise, but it's not helping if it's not kind of taught, if it's not intentional. So same thing with incense. If I just come in swinging incense, no teaching, no reason to get there, and it's not accomplishing anything, it's annoying. It's distracting. If this is a church that's used to a suit and tie pastor and I come in with a clerical collar and never explain why and refuses, this is just what we do, it's a noise. It's annoying. Now, it might be the same noise that's going on in other churches, but if I don't if I don't teach, it's nothing. Yes, sir. Okay. I don't think we're going to get to Hebrews today.
When you don't have something, practicing, like the Lutheran church we went to that did not have the chalice.
Yeah. Oh, yes. So that's the other thing. Let's say you're a Lutheran, you're used to going to Mount Olive Lutheran Church all the time. You go to a church, hypothetically, over there, and you want to have communion, and they don't have a chalice, and they don't have an altar, and you don't know who the pastor is, because every single person on stage all has skinny jeans and a V-neck, and tattoos, and an undercut, and they're all over 40, and dressed like they're 20. And they're, you're, sorry, I'm just hating on these poor guys too much. They're nice, but it's, yes, I went in there and I noticed what was missing first. Let me tell you the first thing I noticed that was missing in that church. I didn't see a cross anywhere in the church. You walk into hopefully any Lutheran church and you'll see a cross or a crucifix. At least one. We have one here, we have one there, we have one there. We've got, I'm sure on the decorations, we've got there, here. We've got crosses and crucifixes on the baptismal font. So you notice when things are missing too. So if you're used to this and then we have a remodeling, we have to reopen Mount Olive Lutheran Church a week later, and you come in and I'm skinny jeans pastor with, and all the crosses are gone. Pastor, where are the crosses? Is a good question to ask. It's just as valid as, Pastor, why are you swinging that metal thing around? They're both valid questions. Yeah, oh boy. What was that? What was the whole point in this rabbit hole? High church and low church. High church is not necessarily more holy. They're different styles of worship. The problem with styles of worship is the way that you worship confesses your doctrine. If you believe that this is a holy place, if you believe that Christ is at the center of everything we do, if the Lord's Supper is important, it should be indicated somehow. Yeah. Yeah, so the font, this is an interesting, I don't want to say I got into a fight with somebody online about this, but I did. it was a good fight. It was a good fight. Because we were talking about where should the font be? And there's different arguments for different placements of the font. When I first came to Mount Olive, the font was up here at the front. The argument for it being at the front is because we want to constantly remember our baptism. It's right there for everybody to see. The argument for it being in the back is that as you're passing into the church, you're remembering that you passed into the church by your baptism. So you're walking by. I put it back there because in the Fort Wayne Seminary, as you're walking in, they've got this huge, well, you can't move it, it's marble. It's built into the structure, this huge baptismal font that you can dip your hands in the water and you can remember your baptism. It's not holy water. And that's one of the reasons I don't put water in that, because I haven't taught enough to say it's not holy water. I'll get to that. But there's some Lutheran churches where they just have water available that you can remind yourself of your baptism. But I put it there because as you're walking past, you remember your baptism. That's why it's there. Could it be up here instead? Absolutely. Would you want to remove the baptismal font entirely from the church? I would say no. Because I want you to remember it. I want you to see it. It's a sacrament. Plus, when I'm doing my sermons, I need to point at that every once in a while. I point at this, I point at that, I point at that. And sometimes I point at all y'all. But yes. For not the same, yeah. I said, you got in that water, and now because he died on that cross, that's placed on you. And that, yeah. I've got like a yarn board or whatever where all the pins. They tie everything. It's all tied together. It's all connected. The baptism, the Lord's Supper, the forgiveness of sins delivered to you in the sacraments. I'm out of time. I opened up the Bible. I didn't even get to Hebrews. I will try again next time. I thought that was going to be like the quickest sort of excursus, the quickest detour. I didn't realize. But hopefully there was something useful in there. It's a coffee. I'm telling you, this is espresso. It's got me going. Let's close with the doxology.